Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Grok Radio. The following broadcast is made possible by the friends and partners of CYI Worldwide Ministries and Grok Radio. And the views expressed in this program and by our guests may not necessarily reflect those of CYI Worldwide Ministries or its staff. And now, enjoy the show.
You stand on the shore of the ocean watching the tide come in. You sense the call of the sea beckoning to take you in further. You step forward little by little, not knowing what to expect, but expecting more. You keep going as the ocean calls you to enter in to deeper waters.
Hello everyone, I'm Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters podcast. It's storming where we're at right now, so let's pray that nothing knocks us off. If I somehow lose my connection to my computer, I do have a backup measure. It'll just take me a little bit, but let's hope that doesn't happen. And right after this show, in fact, I'll be heading out, because for those who might know me on Facebook, today happens to be my wife's birthday, and so we are going to be going out to celebrate that. And right now, we are very fortunate because our string of bad luck has ended. Our guest has made it today. And my guest today is Dr. Craig Keener. Dr. Keener, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, tell us, before we get started with the show, my audience might not know you in some cases, so why should they be listening to what you have to say today?
Because I'm a nice guy. Well, that's probably not what you want to hear. So, I was converted from atheism when I was young. I wasn't raised in church, so I came to all of this kind of from scratch. But my PhD is in New Testament from Duke University, and my main area of research has been in ancient history and the light that sheds on the New Testament. And so some of my works cite like tens of thousands of sources from ancient literature. So in a sense, this work that we're talking about today was going on a different path for me. I was able to use my research skills, but I was applying them to something that was different, but turned out to be totally fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Now, ironically, this book, what we're talking about is a book called Miracles, for those who don't know, and this book is so big, it's not a book. It's two books, and the bibliography is about 300 pages worth. But this book kind of began as an accident, didn't it?
Yes. Yes. it was a footnote in my Acts commentary because I was just dealing with the question, you know, I was dealing with the historical reliability of Acts, since it's a work of ancient historiography. That's a question that, you know, naturally comes up. And one of the questions people raise, since about one-fifth of the book of Acts deals with miracle accounts, was, you know, if you're going to talk about being historically reliable, what about those accounts? And one of the objections that's been around, especially since David Strauss over a century ago, was that, well, you know, eyewitnesses would never claim these things. These are legends. These wouldn't arise from eyewitness accounts. They can't be the claims of people who were actually there, or reflect the claims of people who were actually there. So I say, well, that doesn't make sense, because I know we've got lots of such accounts all over the world today. And whether or not you agree that they're miracles, you can't deny that we have lots of eyewitnesses. In fact, in David Strauss's day, somebody he knew was miraculously healed, and he didn't accept that either. But he couldn't say it was legend if he were consistent. He knew the person. So, I mean, today, once I started digging into it, the footnote grew and grew. I found a study, a Pew Forum study from a few years ago, that noted that, well, given the percentages, we're talking about hundreds of millions of people in the world who claim to have witnessed or experienced divine healing. and that's not to say that every one of those is actually what the person thought it was, but, I mean, you can't say that eyewitnesses don't claim that. So the footnote grew and grew, and I got more and more interested, and after about 200 pages, it was a, of course, by then it was a chapter, but 200 pages was too much, so I proposed it as a book, 200-page book, and then it, by the time it came out, it was, I don't know, what is it, 1,300 pages or something like that. It grew a lot.
Yeah, I'm got right here, and it looks like it ends on page 1,172. Now, that's counting bibliography, index, everything else. So, it was no small difficulty. In fact, I understand your Acts commentary is supposed to be four books, isn't it?
Yeah, four volumes, yes. And very small print.
So, this is someone who does not take these matters lightly. Now, when you started this research, though, on miracles, you were very skeptical still, weren't you?
Well, not skeptical in the sense that I didn't believe in miracles,
mm-hmm.
but skeptical in the sense that I always put the bar of evidence very high, and
mm-hmm.
so I was approaching each individual claim with a much higher degree of skepticism than I did once I just started getting overwhelmed with evidence
mm-hmm.
and realized that these things weren't as rare as I thought they were. And, and I don't know, I probably had some residual, I mean, from the atheist background, but also the book that I'd worked on before this is called Historical Jesus of the Gospels. And
mm-hmm.
for that one, you know, I was using a pretty high bar of evidence. I didn't want to argue for passages. I wasn't saying I didn't agree with them, but I didn't want to argue for things that I couldn't give sufficient evidence for that I thought would be persuasive.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a problem. You get to thinking that way about everything. You know,
mm-hmm.
my wife would say something to me, and I would say, "Can you give me evidence for that assertion?" You know, and of course, I got in trouble, right? Because,
I can't imagine.
Yes. So the thing is, you've got a credible witness. You need to take them seriously, and.
Mm-hmm.
When I was digging into this book, there was some, I guess the turning point for me was I'd interviewed a lot of people, and that was starting to turn my thinking, but when I interviewed some members of my wife's own family, and, you know, some of these things were not like headaches going away or flu going away, they were much more dramatic than that, and that was a turning point. I was trying to, in the book, I was trying to say, okay, here's the evidence for this. You don't have to agree with this. But by the time I was done, it was like, okay, this is where I think the evidence points.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's important to note also for my listeners that it has been a while since Dr. Keener wrote the book, so he doesn't exactly remember everything in the book, but we are going to discuss it to the best of our ability today. Now, when you started, you did start to remember the book better. We do have this distinction today that you didn't seem to think was quite good for us to have with it, yeah, natural and supernatural distinction.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's a distinction that to some extent we have to work with because that's the way the problem has been defined. But it's not actually a good distinction. If you believe in God, then you believe that God is behind the natural order. So it's more like what's his ordinary way of working and what's extraordinary, and that can be a matter of degree.
Yeah.
But I mean, you take something like the parting of the Red Sea, which is kind of the prototypical biblical example of miracle before the resurrection, and I mean it. Pretty much everybody would agree that, you know, the Israelites getting to the Red Sea, the sea parting for them is not something that ordinarily happens on its own, and if that's a coincidence, it's a rather extraordinary coincidence.
Mm-hmm.
But it says in Exodus 14 that God blew back the sea by a strong east wind all night. So in
mm-hmm.
other words, he worked through natural causes. Now, we still say it's extraordinary. The people who don't want to call it a miracle will just say it didn't happen. They won't normally say, well, it happened, but, you know, every once in a while the wind blows back the sea every million years or so, and it just happened when the Israelites got there. That's the level of probability for that kind of coincidence is so abysmally low, it's not a very good argument.
Yeah, the argument that I like to use also in addition to that one, and I think philosophically that's usually called a second-class miracle, where a miracle is done, and the miracle is not that it happened, but that something happened when it happened. But the one I always like to use involves crossing a body of water also, and that's for crossing the Jordan River, because in the biblical account, when the people are stepped into the water, then it all stopped, and they were able to pass through. And when they came out, the water started flowing again. Now, we have had other cases of that happening in history to that river. We've got them documented. But that it happened when it happened is the miracle. And we could also use other examples, like some people think Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed by a volcano, where that it happened when it happened is a miracle.
Yes, right after God had independently told Abraham what was going to happen.
But when you talk about how this is approached in the West, in the academy, there seems to be a natural bias that we all have, even if we're Christians, against miracles. And this is a result that we've pretty much soaked up much of our culture, even unintentionally, right?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, what we'll do is if it's something that we can explain in natural terms, We might say, okay, well, maybe the witness is telling the truth, but this is really what happened. And then if it's something we can't explain in natural terms, then we question the credibility of the witness, which means we're starting with an overwhelming bias, not an open mind, an overwhelming bias against miracles with such a high bar of evidence that nothing would convince us. That's not really being open to evidence.
Well, let's suppose then we've got someone out there who's an agnostic or an atheist, and they're listening to this right now, and they're hearing this, and they know we're going to be going into some miracle claims here. What would be your advice for them as they listen to this show today and hear miracle claims, whether from you or from people who call in with their own miracle claims?
Well, just to be open-minded. I mean, an agnostic, by definition, is open-minded if they're generally agnostic, but I mean, when I was an atheist, I thought I was a pretty certain atheist, but I was open-minded enough to be convinced by sufficient evidence. But sometimes what people will do is say, well, I'm willing to be convinced by evidence, and sometimes I've had dialogues with people who say that, but like sometimes they'll say, well, if somebody were raised from the dead in front of them, they wouldn't believe. And so my question then is, what kind of evidence would you be open to? I think too often people are not really honest about their presuppositions and willing to entertain other kinds of evidence.
Now, on the same strata, I suppose I've someone could come and give a natural explanation for every single miracle you have in this book, that you'd be willing to accept that, right?
Some people could give a natural explanation for the sea parting and so on, but the question is that a plausible explanation? I mean, if you're saying, okay, well, there's only a 0.02% chance that this happened naturally, then what you're admitting is that your argument isn't very strong, that you're just willing to say, okay, it has to be naturalistic, that has to be the right explanation. And if you're going to say, well, okay, I don't have any answer for this, but someday science will have an answer for it. Well, you know, science often does come up with answers, and we're thankful for that. But you're admitting that at this point you don't have an argument. And so why not be open to another possible explanation?
In fact, when I hear that kind of argument, I keep thinking that's the atheistic version of a God of the gaps, that
yes.
somehow we're going to find a way for naturalism to fill that gap. And so why not think, well, right now we don't have it, why not go by the evidence that we do have right now instead of using evidence that we don't have and we might never have?
Yeah, because when you're deferring the question that way, saying, well, maybe I'll have an explanation someday, mm-hmm. well, that's legitimate, but when you have to do that too many times,
mm-hmm.
I think what comes out is that you're not really open to another explanation. You're just trying to defend the thesis that you can't have a supernatural explanation. And you're not really engaging in dialogue or in logic at that point. You're just trying to defend your position.
Mm-hmm. And I've heard Dr. Habermas use this approach in a debate. Also, when you talk about the resurrection of Jesus, he says, look, if I got up here and I told you the Bible is the word of God, the Bible says Jesus is raised, therefore Jesus is raised, you wouldn't accept that because you don't accept the first premise. Now, if I can't use my worldview as a premise in the argument, why should you get to use your worldview as a premise in the argument?
Yes.
Now, when we're talking about doing this kind of research, I did some of it on my own as well, and maybe you found this also. When you just start going out to churches and such and asking people, do you have any accounts of miracles in your own life? That it can be incredible how many stories you start hearing.
Yeah. From people I knew and from people who were my students, actually, I got more accounts after the book was done,
mm.
including of raisings from the dead and
mm-hmm.
and dramatic instances like that.
And these weren't from gullible types who we would say would just believe anything. These are from people who are very, by and large, rational, consistent thinkers who aren't prone to saying everything is a miracle or something like that. These are people who we could even say, for the sake of argument, their testimony would be acceptable generally in a court of law, for instance.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. In fact, that was one of my main criteria. Now, in the book, there are different sections of the book, and so there's some
mm-hmm.
sections
yep.
where I'm just surveying the kinds of claims that people make, and I'm not passing
mm-hmm.
judgment on them, pro or con. But then
yeah.
there are others where I was very strongly convinced, and I could say so. I mean, people that I knew personally and their integrity
mm-hmm.
I knew, or people who were vouched for very strongly by people that I knew. That was one of the criteria. I mean, it's a historic criterion for the reliability of eyewitnesses. That was one of the criteria that I used.
Mm-hmm. And, in fact, this is the same standard that you used when you've done New Testament scholarship as well.
Right.
Mm. Okay.
It's a standard that, you know, some people don't like. They want to rule out witnesses altogether, which
yeah.
Doesn't really work. I mean, certain disciplines don't use witnesses, but
mm-hmm.
other disciplines depend heavily, history, journalism, and so on. In personal relationships, we depend on testimony.
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't do those things without it. Now, to take the epistemology of one discipline and to put that over all other disciplines and say, okay, well, this discipline is hogwash, we don't know anything about history because it depends too much on witnesses, it's like the story that is sometimes told of the ichthyologist who had a net to collect fish, specimens for fish, that he could study, and yet the net, because of the size of the net, the small fish didn't get caught in it much, and so he concluded that the small fish didn't exist because he didn't find them. He said, if they existed, I would find them. Well, he couldn't find them because his net couldn't catch them because of the size of the net, and epistemologies have to be adapted to the goal, the objective, the discipline. They're not like one size fits all.
Okay, well, we're going to be getting into this a little bit further here. But for now, we're going to take our first break. My guest is Dr. Craig Keener. If you want to call in, the number is 714-242-5180. And we'll be back after this break.
Join Unituber and Army Girl for Christ as they discuss spiritual warfare, spiritual preparedness, the end times, life issues, and personal and spiritual growth. That's www.truthradionet.com. Truthradionet.com.
And we're back. I'm Nick Peters. My guest is Dr. Craig Keener. We're discussing miracles. Our call-in number is 714-242-5180. And if you have your own miracle story, I'd love to hear from you. Just give a call in and share it. But since we don't know how many people are calling in, of course, I'm going to ask that you simply be brief and to the point. And remember, we're looking for a real miracle story. Getting a good parking spot at Walmart, by and large, does not count as a miracle. But now, when we're talking about miracles, Dr. Keener, one name that will come up in response every single time is David Hume.
Yes.
Now, you, by nature, are not a philosopher. That's not your area of study. But you did write some chapters on Hume. So what was it like when you're having to kind of step outside your area here?
It was stretching. It was useful. There were certain parts that really were, they really stretched me to my limit. But dealing with Hume himself was actually not quite as hard, especially because of Hume's historical context. I mean, I'm a historian, and so to read Hume in context, so many of his arguments were simply taken over from certain kinds of deists.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Hume, people often will say, well, Hume's argument doesn't make sense. Hume's argument is incomplete. Part of that is because Hume was taking for granted a larger argumentation from the deists and writing a short essay that took some of that for granted. But his arguments actually don't work very well today, and I think the majority of scholars, I read everything I could find on it, the majority of scholars who've written specifically on Hume's essay on miracles don't think it's a very good argument. Some call it an absurd argument, and Hume still has his defenders also. But Hume's first argument is that miracles are a violation of nature, and therefore nature can't be violated. You know, that's a circular argument. Some people have said, well, he doesn't mean that. He simply means that that we could never know based on the laws of nature. What we have to expect are the laws of nature. But Hume's arguments in the laws of nature doesn't work with any understanding of natural law that is used today. For example, well, actually, most importantly, laws of nature today are usually viewed as descriptive of what we find out there. So You can't really use them prescriptively to say this can't happen. Otherwise, you would preclude scientific discovery. It actually kind of goes against Hume's own epistemology. But his second argument is the one that I really went after in the book, and that is he argues that we don't have any credible eyewitness evidence for miracles, credible enough to overcome the prejudice. Starting prejudice against it, he tries to argue that there's no credible eyewitness evidence for miracles. Now, if he got away with that in his day, which he shouldn't have, because there was credible eyewitness evidence in his day, it's really hard to take that as a premise today, when we know from all sorts of sources that there are hundreds of millions of people who claim to have seen or experienced miracles. Again, you don't have to agree that every one of those is a miracle, but you can't start with the premise based on, you can't start with the premise that eyewitnesses, credible eyewitnesses don't claim this, and then just go on to dismiss miracles. Because it's a circular argument. You have to dismiss hundreds of millions of people's witness as not credible without any evidence. Can I give some statistics on this?
Well, before we do that, it looks like we've got a caller who's wanting to call in. You want to talk to the caller first?
Sure.
Okay. Caller, you're on the air with Dr. Craig Keener.
Hello, sir. Is it me?
What?
Hello?
What's that?
Hello, we hear you.
All right, sir. I have a miracle claim I'd like to share.
Okay.
My lead pastor at my Assemblies of God Church was diagnosed with cancer in his back in late June of this year. And obviously, as a Pentecostal church, we did our share of praying, and he was completely free in mid-July to late July, and he's growing his six pack, and he's still healthy.
Okay, Dr. Keener, what do you think about this?
We have, now this is this year?
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Yeah. Obviously, this is something to thank God for. But as to whether it's incapable of a naturalistic explanation, one reason I didn't focus on cancer cures so much in the book is because sometimes people say, well, cancers go into remission, and then they come back later. So usually we wait for a certain number of years before we say, in terms of medical documentation, we usually wait for a certain number of years before we say, okay, this can be used as evidence. Now, saying that something can be used as evidence in a certain kind of forum, or saying that we wouldn't use that as evidence, doesn't mean that it's not a miracle. It just means that it wouldn't meet some people's standards of the bar of skepticism that some people would use. So, I mean, if I'm in the church, I'm going to be praising God for this testimony. But it probably wouldn't be one of the ones that I would use to try to prove something to somebody who...
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Mm.
But
now,
again, please understand I'm not saying it wasn't God's working at all.
Yeah.
Yes, sir. I understand what you're saying.
But, Dr. Keener, you are saying, though, I think that if, say, 7 or 8 years down the line that there's still no cancer coming back, then we have more of a case for a miracle, right?
Yeah. No, I'm not saying it's not a miracle, but I'm just saying in terms of making an argument for certain kinds of settings, yeah, we would probably want to wait before using that. Some things are just, you know, they're kind of visible. If cataracts instantly disappear in plain sight, that's like instant. There's no way to explain that in natural terms. At least, you know, if it ever happens naturally, it is so very rare that for us to have so many testimonies of it happening during prayer is, you know, that... Anyway.
Yes, sir. The only thing I would like to add about this is that he went in for the diagnosis and got the CAT scan, I believe, and it showed how much it was. And by the... And before he started chemotherapy, he went back in and got a second CAT scan, and it was, in fact, smaller.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. I would recommend also that you keep any medical documentation for further study later on and such. You can use this later on if it stays that way.
Yeah. And you, I may be misunderstanding you. If you're saying that the cancer had actually metastasized already and then
no, sir. I am meaning that the tumor had shrank between hospital visits.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's excellent news, and it's good to keep praying and thanking God for it.
Thank you for calling in, caller.
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. Now, Dr. Keener, you were going to give us statistics on what was going on in Hume's time, right?
Oh, no, actually, I was going to give statistics for just to illustrate how widespread healing claims are today. Now, again,
okay.
These run a gamut of what people mean, but so it's just like a ballpark figure.
Mm-hmm.
The Pew study among Pentecostals and Charismatics in just 10 countries alone, the estimate comes out to somewhere around 200 million people.
Mm-hmm.
And in those same 10 countries, for people who don't claim to be Pentecostal or Charismatic, they among Christians, the figures were about 39% claimed to have witnessed or experienced divine healing. So,
mm-hmm.
again, we're talking about hundreds of millions of people. It didn't cover some countries, for instance, China, where about 10 years ago, a source from within the Three Self Church suggested that about half of all new conversions in the past 10 years have been due to what they called faith healing experiences. And a source from within the house church movement suggested that especially in the rural areas it could be as high as 90%. Now there's no way to know, you know, to make those figures exact, but again we're talking about in China that would be tens of millions of people, and these are people not Christians who are saying, well, you know, I have reason to believe in healing, and so this is how I'm interpreting the evidence. These are people who were not Christians and became
mm-hmm.
Christians because they were so convinced. In fact,
mm-hmm.
there was a survey done in a major city in India around 1981 or something around there in Chennai, what was in Madras. And the survey, according to the survey, about 10% of non-Christians in that city claimed to have experienced divine healing through prayer in the name of Jesus.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, what's important about this, and I think especially China's, these aren't exactly third world countries always that we're talking about. These are countries that do have modern science in many cases and still have miracles going on, right?
Yes, and of course here they happen too.
Mm. In fact, this is part of a critique of Hume, because something that I thought was very revealing to bring out in the book is part of what affected Hume so much of his argument is he was really quite racist in his views, wasn't he?
Yeah. Hume said that only ignorant and barbarous peoples believe in miracles.
Mm-hmm.
And in another of his works, he says that no race except white people, he calls the others different species, he says no race other than white people has ever produced any civilization, anything worthy of note. And he says, oh yeah, well I've heard of this one Jamaican who can recite poetry, but any parrot can repeat what it's heard. And yet the Jamaican to whom he's referring, Francis Williams, was a Cambridge graduate who composed his own poetry both in English and in Latin.
You know, it's so, very interesting that you just said that, because I have your book here and I had it open to that very page. And here is the quote from Hume itself. He says, not to mention our colonies, there are Negro slaves dispersed all over Europe, of which none ever discovered any symptoms of ingenuity, though low people without education were started amongst us whites and distinguished themselves in every profession. In Jamaica, indeed, they talk of one Negro as a man of parts and learning, but 'tis likely he is mired for very slender accomplishments, like a parrot who speaks a few words plainly.
Yeah, I find that offensive.
And, you know, it's very revealing also that he says that it's likely that this is what it is, which tells us Hume didn't really do any research into who this fellow was.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, one person on the internet critiqued my argument on this, but I think he misrepresented it. He said, you know, Keener is saying that atheists who don't believe in miracles are racist. I was not saying that.
No.
In fact, I was pretty explicit what I was saying. My argument was just that that argument of Hume is racist.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Hume's racism was so well known, his anti-Semitism was well known, that even a century later, people were still citing his arguments, his racist arguments. In his own day, he made it very hard for the Christian abolitionists who were working to abolish slavery in Britain, because, you know, the anti-abolitionists were using Hume's arguments in support of slavery.
Mm-hmm.
So,
now,
the idea that you have to rule out testimony from other cultures is an inherently ethnocentric and racist argument.
Yeah, it's important that we have to be clear, like you were saying, about what we were saying. We're not saying Hume's wrong because he was racist. You could be a racist and still be right in your philosophy in many areas. We're saying his racism had a direct impact on what he said because it allowed him to discount claims from people that were outside of his approved circle.
Yeah. Now, of course, he did it not just with other nations. He did it also with some people in Western culture as well, but that's another that's another story.
And it's quite important to keep in mind, like you've said, that there are several philosophers who have had a negative view of Hume's approach. In fact, just I think it was yesterday even, I finished reading the book Hume's Abject Failure.
Yeah,
one that I'm sure you remember reading. And it's by John Ehrman, who is an agnostic. And to call the argument an abject failure is one of the worst insults you could give to a philosophical argument.
Yes. And somebody had criticized this author, saying, oh, you just said that because you're a Christian, to which he responded, actually, I'm not a Christian. I just think it was a bad argument.
Yeah. And the problem with Hume's argument is, not only does it not work, but it would also kill modern science today, because you'd have to go on testimony that you don't have of things that can't be believed at the time. There's no distinction between a miracle and a marvel in the argument.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Science is wonderful, and science has a limited epistemology, and that's what it's supposed to do. I mean, it's supposed to work that way. Science deals with what's replicable. Miracles, by definition, are not replicable. They're like, you know, my interaction with my wife is not entirely predictable. I mean, there's certain things that are predictable because of our relationship, but you don't put it in the same way that you do, say, the making predictions about physics. A relationship with a super intelligent God, you're not going to expect events to be replicable. You can expect that there'll be more than one miracle, but you can't predict where and when they're going to occur. So, you know, it doesn't. The method of experimentation is not the appropriate method, but you can still use observation, and you can. That's where the witnesses come in. That's where we use empirical observation, and we record what happens.
Well, it's about time that we go and take another break. We could have spent a lot more time on Hume, but I know there's so much more to cover. So for the sake of argument, we're going to be assuming for the rest of the show that the Humean objection has been dealt with. And if anyone wants to see more of that, there is extensive information on Keener's work. And he does cite numerous philosophers, since this is outside his field. So you can go and read the people that he cites as well. But we are going to take our break. Our call-in number is 714-242-5180. We want to hear your miracle claims also, and we'll be back after this.
It's here, the official Grok Radio mobile app. Listen to your favorite Grok Radio programs on your iPhone, iPad, iPod, Kindle Fire, Android smartphone, and tablet. The best thing is, it's absolutely free. Download it now from the iTunes or Google Play App Store, or get a link at our website, CYIWorldwide.com. Rock radio, Christian radio that doesn't suck.
Okay, and we're back with Dr. Craig Keener. The call-in number is 714-242-5180. And now we're going to start talking about the miracles themselves. Now, one aspect that's very interesting about this, Dr. Keener, is that miracles are near and personal to you because they've happened in your own family.
Yes. Yes. Now, I should say before going into some of those that they don't always happen.
Right.
I mean, my wife and I have been through a series of miscarriages, and and of course, well, I say of course, but for those who know me, they know I wear glasses, and they know I'm ADD. You can probably tell by the way I'm speaking too. But anyway, but yes, we've had a number of miracles take place, and one that was very dramatic to me. We went to Congo Brazzaville, where my wife is from. She has a PhD from the University of Paris. Her brother, who was also one of my informants, also has a PhD from France, and he's a chemistry professor. But when we went to Congo Brazzaville, in 3 weeks of just interviewing people in the people that my wife knew very well, they were close friends of the family that were trusted. We got 7 eyewitness accounts of people being raised from the dead. These were not from Pentecostals. I mean, I welcome the Pentecostals' testimonies too, but this was from the mainline Protestant denomination. And the person who really had the most dramatic impact on me, though, was I was talking with Antoinette Malambe, and I'd heard this story from my wife, but I didn't really. It was different hearing it in person because I could ask questions, get more details that my wife didn't really know. The Antoinette Malambe talked about how her daughter Therese had been bitten by a snake, and by the time the mother got to her, she wasn't breathing. And there was no medical help available in the village, so she strapped the child to her back and ran to a nearby village where evangelist Coco Ngoma Moise, who was a friend of the family, was doing some ministry. And he prayed for Therese. She started breathing. The next day she was fine. And today she has a master's degree and is working back in Congo. But I asked Antoinette Malambe, how long was it that she wasn't breathing? And she had to stop and think about, you know, how long it took to get from, you know, the one village to the other with the different mountains in between and so on. She said about 3 hours. Now, Therese is my sister-in-law. Antoinette Malambe is my mother-in-law. And that was kind of an eye-opener for me. And once my eyes were opened in that way, I started asking some of my other friends, kind of open-endedly, from Africa and elsewhere, about miracle stories. And I had over 10 in my own circle of friends, eyewitness accounts of people being raised from the dead, some of them for as long as 8 hours. I mean, you know, as far as anybody could tell, they were dead, but they revived when they were prayed for. I was sharing some of this in a scholars meeting, not from the standpoint that, you know, all of us would agree that miracles happen, but just saying, you know, maybe when we read the Gospels, we could read them more sympathetically if we would listen to some majority world perspectives that hadn't been shaped by Hume. And after I talked about this and gave the example of my sister-in-law, a Nigerian professor in the back, in his case he is Pentecostal, he stood up and he said, my son was born, stillborn, and we prayed for half an hour, In the book I said 20 minutes. He's corrected me that I got it wrong. It was half an hour. And he revived, came back to life, and now he has a Master of Science degree from the University of London. There are just so many. I could keep going for a long time, but there are just lots and lots of these.
And Dr. Keener, we've got someone else who looks like he may want to call and may want to talk to you. You want? Oh, they just hung up. Carl,
sorry.
If you want to try and call back in, please do so. I was just waiting for Dr. Keener to finish his thought here, but we'd love to hear from you. And if anyone else wants to call in, our number is 714-242-5180. Now, someone I can already tell with a human perspective might say, well, Nigeria and the Congo, this is part of a third world, though. So, I mean, obviously, these people just probably don't know any better and can't really recognize America. Now, I'm not saying that, but that could be the perspective of our skeptic out there, that these are people who really lack scientific knowledge. If they had scientific knowledge, they'd know that America hadn't taken place. What would you say to that?
Well, the examples I just gave were people with PhDs in the family, but first of all, I think it's a racist argument.
Yeah, it is.
But secondly, I mean, who is more apt to be able to detect whether a person is not breathing or not? Somebody who lives around those things, or somebody who is insulated from it? Because in our culture, you know, it's always been in the hospital. I mean, you know, doctors and nurses are the most qualified to know. But I have some accounts from doctors and nurses about these things too, including from the West.
Mm-hmm.
There was a cardiologist that I interviewed where the person had been flatlined, I believe, for 40 minutes or so. And, you know, they'd already pronounced him dead. The cardiologist had already gone back to make his rounds. He was a Christian. He felt like the Spirit moved him to go back and pray for the man. He prayed for the man. He did shock him with the paddle one more time, which, you know, he's a doctor. Obviously, he's going to use medical means. But you know, immediately, the person's heartbeat was normal, went from flatline to normal after, you know, the person had been pronounced dead. And the nurse started screaming, "Dr. Crandall, Dr. Crandall, what have you done?" Because, you know, if his heart starts again, but he has irreparable brain damage after 6 minutes with no oxygen, what are you going to have? But the man was restored. The doctor went in and talked with him a couple days later, and having conversation with him, the man's extremities, this man was white, his extremities had already turned black, but they were restored. So we have accounts here as well. But by the way, with regard to the caller, I hope I didn't scare them off. You know, with the first caller, I hope I didn't leave the wrong impression. I wasn't saying that God didn't do something. I was just saying, you know, in terms of what we use to persuade mm-hmm. people who don't believe, some mm-hmm. kinds of evidence are more compelling than other kinds of evidence.
Yeah. Something also I think we could use, for instance, my wife's grandmother just passed away last month, as I'm sure you know, but I just got done reading your book last year sometime, and she was in the middle of stage 4 breast cancer then, and now I kept thinking, oh, I just wish I could spend one more Thanksgiving with her. I'm not sure she's going to make it to Thanksgiving. I just want one more. Now, I was writing a review of your book and getting ready to put it up on Amazon, and just as I was doing that, we got a phone call saying that the cancer had all gone away. And I was like, this is something incredible. Now, she did pass away last month with stage 5 brain cancer. I'd returned, but I look at it still and I think what happened there is God did answer my wife's prayer and said, one more Thanksgiving, you're going to get to have that one. And that's what happened.
Yeah. Something like that happened with my father-in-law where he did recover from what we prayed for him for. A year later, he passed away from something unrelated to that. But, you know, again, some things are more persuasive to the person who's not inclined to believe than others are. But we can still experience things that, you know, not everything is going to persuade everybody, but we can still experience them as answers to prayer.
Yeah. Now, going to your example of what happened here in the Western Hospital, there also seems to be a kind of catch-22 that if something happens in a society like, say, the Congo, where there's not scientific care everywhere and such, you don't find a hospital on every street corner, where then that's just the people were gullible there. But if it happens over here, it's because where they got really good medical care. But either way, there is a way to explain it away.
Right. Because, yeah, here, if somebody's had medical treatment, we say, well, it's because they had medical treatment. If somebody hasn't had medical treatment, we say, well, then we can't verify it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the way the rules are set up, it makes it very difficult. Now, there are cases that I think are very strongly medically verified, but the standards of evidence that people sometimes use. Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, okay. The standards of evidence that people sometimes use are not really consistent.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we're talking also about people in the third world and such, something I've brought out in some of my blog posts I've written is, and this would extend to people in biblical times because they didn't have modern science like we do, and we're told, well, people would believe things like that so easily back then. Well, first off, I think that's nonsense. I think there was a huge skepticism towards miracles back then, and maybe you can comment more on that as well. But also, even if that wasn't the case, they might not have had the scientific knowledge we had, but we can't assume they were stupid either. I mean, what I've told people is they knew that when someone died, you buried them because they weren't coming back. They knew that if someone was pregnant, it was because a man and woman had sex together. It wasn't because a virgin had miraculously been impregnated. They knew water doesn't just immediately turn into wine. The things that we think they were so dumb about, if they happened today, by most of them, we'd consider it a miracle.
Yeah, and some of those have been reported today. Not the virgin conceiving, but it's true. There, of course, there was a range in the ancient world from gullibility to skepticism, just like there is today.
Yeah.
But it's true. If people who have been converted, for example, in China, in India, in Nepal, in some parts of the world, the majority of conversions have been due to either being healed or knowing somebody who was. That means that the way they experienced these things was different from the way they experienced other kinds of recoveries. It wasn't just the kind of thing that they normally expected to happen.
Dr. Keener, it looks like we do have another caller calling in. You want to take it?
Sure.
Okay. Caller, you are on the air of Dr. Craig Keener.
I was just listening. Uh-huh. Nice to meet you all.
Nice to meet you.
Do you have something you want to ask Dr. Keener about?
Ma'am, I don't even know the format of the show. I just saw a minister, and so I said, well, that sounds like a religious program.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're here discussing miracles today. You can listen through Blog Talk Radio. If you've got a miracle claim, we'd certainly be open to hearing it.
Well, no, ma'am.
Okay. Well, I'm going to ask that you just keep listening to the show and hope you keep enjoying it.
Thank you.
Thank you for calling.
Thank you, sir. God bless.
God bless you.
Okay. Well, if anyone does want to call in with a miracle, it is 714-242-5180. Now, you talked about people in India and such. I was listening to some conversations you did with being interviewed by someone at Asbury, and you talked about a leader in, I think it was India, who was hostile to the Christian message until his son needed some help.
Yeah, I don't know that he was hostile, but he wasn't a believer.
Okay.
If we're thinking of the right story, there's another story of somebody who was hostile, but that wasn't in India. This person was he had tried everything. He'd sacrificed to different deities. It was among the Nishi tribal people in northeast India. He'd sacrificed to different deities.
What was wrong with his son there?
He was dying. He was very sick. The father went to the pharmacist and asked him if there was anything else that could be done. And they tried different medicines and so on. The pharmacist said, well, you've tried everything else. Why not try praying to Jesus, the Christian God? Because he raised Lazarus from the dead. So he got home. His son had died. And again, this is as far as anybody could tell because they didn't have ways to check those things. But he said, God... And I'm not guaranteeing this happens all the time, but he said, God, if you raise my son from the dead the way you did Lazarus, then I will follow Jesus. And his son came back. He was converted, and it was the start of a people movement among the Nishi tribal people. Such huge numbers of that people group had become Christian, but that's the account that they give at the beginning of the movement among them.
Mm-hmm.
There's one where a man was hostile from a Hindu background. I don't know how serious he was about his Hinduism, but he was hostile. This one took place in Suriname, and he was defying the Christians. Now, he was my informant, who was actually an eyewitness, thought that the man was like maybe 70 or even 80 years old.
Mm-hmm.
But all of his life, one of his arms had been paralyzed. Well, suddenly, as he's shouting against them, his paralyzed arm shot up in the air, and it was no longer paralyzed. And he looked at it, and he was converted, and most of the crowd was converted. And that was the beginning of a people movement in Nickery, Suriname, where mm-hmm. where for hundreds of years they had had just a few hundred Christians. Now they have, I believe, 10,000 or tens of thousands mm-hmm. of Christians there.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you talk about the beginning of a people movement, what do you mean exactly?
The beginning of a mass turning of people to faith
okay.
in Christ.
Okay, I want to be sure about the term especially. Now, you've said also that this it isn't something that happens every time. This is something we have to be clear of repeatedly, that Jesus and Jesus' name is not a magic charm, that it's not going to make everything go away every single time, that God's not at our bidding, we're at His. But it's important, I think, to point out that there are many cases that people could say, I prayed and I didn't get healed, or I prayed for someone else and they didn't get healed. But that's not a disproof against the many times that someone does get healed.
Right. Yeah. If it happened automatically, mm-hmm. we would find a law of nature to explain it with. You know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's something that it's out of a personal relationship with God. Sometimes God does it. Sometimes we grow in our relationship with God through faith in a different way, having to go through the hardship.
Mm-hmm.
In the Gospels, when Jesus was healing people, he explained it in light of prophecy in Isaiah about the coming of the kingdom, the coming of an mm-hmm. era of restoration. And,
yeah.
you know, the kingdom has not been completed. Some of it is still future. But these were signs, these were samples.
Mm-hmm.
They're a
mm-hmm.
foretaste of the time when God will restore us fully. They're meant to give
mm-hmm.
us hope in a world that otherwise would seem without hope. But there's an even deeper message in the Gospels, and that is that in the cross, in the epitome of suffering and injustice, God was still at work, even in that suffering, to bring about His purposes in the long
mm-hmm.
run. So we can have hope even in the midst of suffering, but we serve a God who is able and often does do miracles, and they're a foretaste of a time of complete restoration.
Yeah, I've got something I'd like to add to that, but I'm going to save it for when we come back from a break. Our call-in number is 714-242-5180. We'll be back after this.
Check out CYIWorldwide.com. CYIWorldwide.com, home of Grok Radio. Free music downloads, advice, prayer, and support. CYIWorldwide.com. Do you grok?
Are you tired of the same old corporate Christian music on the radio? Check out Music Surge on Grok Radio, playing Christian music that doesn't suck. Download episodes now at CYIWorldwide.com.
And we're back with Dr. Craig Keener. Our call-in number is 714-242-5180. And if you're going to be here next week and you're listening to the podcast, we are going to have as our guest next week Bill McKeever of the Mormon Research Ministry. We're going to be talking about Mormonism next week. I urge you to be listening in. Now, Dr. Keener, you're talking about people who aren't healed and sometimes God working through suffering. Immediately my mind went to a case that I know about very well. I spoke last Sunday morning at a church for a Disability Awareness Day. As I'm sure you know, my wife and I are both disabled. And the ministry we worked with there was Johnny and Friends, which is the ministry of Johnny Erickson Tada. And for those who don't know her, she had a swimming accident, and she's paralyzed now as a quadriplegic. She has never been healed, but her condition has allowed her to be a door for so many to experience the goodness of God. And I think what we could say with something like this is, if God does not decide to heal someone, that someone can still rest assured, if they will be willing, God can use what they have for His glory.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we're talking about other healing claims, you mentioned one earlier when we're talking about Carla about seeing cataracts fall off someone's eyes, but I think you've got an account of cataracts falling off of someone's eyes, don't you?
Oh, several of those. But one is from a friend, and again, I'm appealing first to people that I know. Although there are many other accounts, there's actually also an account of there are actually some medically documented accounts of eye scarring disappearing immediately after prayer, but this one isn't medically documented because it wasn't in a place where that was available. But my friend was there to witness it, and actually somebody else was there also, and I was able to interview both of them. But this was a blind man in northern India that they prayed for, and you know, his eyes, they said, were flat and clouded. Which I assume means that he had cataracts, the clouded part, because his eyes weren't that way after they prayed for him. But he could see after that, and immediately after that. And all the rest of the day he was walking around the area looking at all the trees, and he testified to the people that night, but he began to weep. And they said, "Why are you weeping?" He said, "Because all my life I could hear the children, but now I can see them."
Mm-hmm.
And there are a number of other accounts. There's one, I don't know if it was cataracts, but the woman was blind. A friend of mine from Congo DRC, who's now president of a university there, he was asked to pray for her. He'd never done that before, but they decided that it'd come out so that Jesus' name would be glorified. So they prayed for this woman, and they were praying for about 2 minutes, and she suddenly started shouting, "I can see, I can see!" And for the rest of her life, she was able to see. And there are just lots of other accounts.
Mike Lacona was on our show about a month or so ago. A little over a month ago. And one thing he said about miracles is that one sign of God acting in a miracle is a religious context. And usually with these claims that you've given, there is a religious context around that. It just always seems to happen after prayer in Jesus' name.
Yeah.
And this,
yeah, that's good. Yeah.
This gets really problematic for the skeptic afterwards. He wants to say it's all coincidence because it just every single time seems to coincidentally just happen when Jesus is mentioned.
Yeah, and you know, I was thinking of that when we were dealing, when I was dealing with the issue of just how many people in my own circle knew people who'd been raised from the dead. I mean, if you would expect, you know, okay, well, sometimes a person seems to be dead, and you know, just you have an anomaly. But if you say that the chances are maybe 1 in 1,000 of that happening in somebody's circle, if you start adding up the if you say it's a coincidence, it just happens that the writer of this book had somebody in a circle, but to have 10 in my circle, I mean, if it's 1 in 1,000, you know, multiplying the 1,000 by itself 10 times over, what would that be? That would be something like 10 to the 13th power.
Yes.
In any case, that's more than the world's population. What you're talking about for coincidence there is just so extraordinary that you're admitting that the likelihood of your case is abysmally small.
And all this is done just to preserve an idea that miracles can't happen. I mean, we could even say at the start, we're not even arguing for Christianity being true, although Jesus' name consistently does seem to argue for that. We're just arguing that miracles are happening. It could be miracles are happening and Christianity's false, but it's hard to hear of this and deny miracles are happening.
Yeah, I think so.
And I think you've even talked about that there are whole churches in countries like South America, and they're built right after miracles start taking place because people convert en masse when they see the miracles happening.
Yes. Yeah, many, many places are like that. A Korean scholar did her dissertation on a people group in the northern Philippines that practiced a traditional religion, and just, I think most of the people group over the span of a few years became Christian because they saw miracles taking place in the name of Jesus. And most traditional religions, they have religious ways of dealing with these things, and sometimes they see what a skeptic would call anomalies also, and yet they were so much more persuaded by the miracles that were taking place in the name of Jesus that vast numbers of them became followers of Jesus.
You know, something that we're also usually told by the skeptical crowd is, well, why don't we ever get any of these on videotape? And that's always stunned me some, because we can have so many things on videotape today that we know are faked. And so I think, you know, if I showed a videotape to someone of, say, cataracts falling off of someone's eyes, they'd think, faked.
Yeah, the standard gets changed as soon as you produce it. We do have videotapes of people getting healed. We have a number of videotapes of people getting healed. But how do we know that it's authentic? I would rather go with somebody I can interview, and they can give me their report, and especially if I've got corroborating interviewees for some of these cases, people who knew that they had the condition before, they don't have it now. We do have some of these on videotape, but as you pointed out, people keep changing the bar of evidence. You produce videotape, they say, well, we don't accept that. You produce medical documentation, which we have in a number of cases. Some people will say, I think some people will be persuaded, but some people will say, well, medical documentation isn't enough. We need controlled studies. Well, once you get to controlled studies, you're back to the problem of replicability. And another problem, most of the controlled studies, you know, you say, well, we had people praying for we had a group assigned to pray for these people. We didn't have a group assigned to pray for those people, and about the same number of them got well. Well, but most of the people that you didn't have somebody praying for them, they had people praying for them. And actually, also something in some of those studies that's been interesting is the groups that they got to pray for the people are not the groups that normally claim that divine healing takes place very often. Candy Gunther Brown, in her recent book, Testing Prayer, by Harvard University Press, deals with some of those studies, and it's just interesting. But we do have some medical journal articles that recount healings, and we also do have a number of cases. And there's also a group called Global Medical Research Institute that is now working on collecting more documentation, which I think is very important. So, as you said earlier to the caller, it is good to get everything, keep all the medical documentation.
Now, something else that we often hear today is the standard answer of why doesn't God heal amputees? But I think in your book you do have some interesting cases along those lines, at least in some cases limbs kind of lengthening in response to that change that's happening right before someone's eyes.
Yeah, we do have some cases like that. I mean, it's not the majority of healing claims by any means, but on the other hand, neither are most, I mean, we don't have any of those accounts in the Bible, so it's not like that that's usually how things happen. But there are a number of these, and I'm actually looking through to see where I can...
I can actually think of one account we have in the Bible, and that's where Malthus had his ear put back on.
True. Oh, that's true. Okay. Yeah, actually, if you can include the smaller things like that, we do have a number of cases like that. Yeah, here I have a list. Just wanted to see. I've got a number of them in the list. I mean, we have some things that are fairly small, like teeth being filled, which sounds kind of corny sometimes to us in the West who have good dentists, but some of these are medically documented. And we also have, people with missing parts restored. Some of these are people that I don't know, but some people that I do know. There's one with eye socket filled. There's one with, actually this one was in a journal, a punctured eye that was restored. We have cases of shriveled legs growing back. One that I got from a doctor where the person had a big gaping wound in his leg, and the doctor laid hands on it and prayed. It didn't fill up instantly, but within a week the wound was filled. And I asked him, can that happen on its own? And he sounded really annoyed with my lack of medical knowledge. He said, of course that can't happen on its own. Another case where there was a deep wound that was over 4 inches wide, and this one comes from a doctor, where it was healed overnight. Another case where this is eyewitness testimony from a friend of mine about his brother, whose skin had been burned all over. It was instantly healed. It went from just being glowing red to pink instantly during prayer. And lumps vanishing in plain sight. Some of these are recorded in the literature. Some of these are friends of mine who witnessed these things. In a case of a leg that grew out, it was four inches over the course of a day. There are some with like missing toes and things, or fingers growing back. I wasn't able to verify those, though. Those are reports, but I couldn't interview the people. One with the restoration of salivary glands that had been destroyed, that was medically documented. So there are a number of examples like that.
So when we have someone stand up like Mike or Shermer saying, why doesn't God heal amputees? And we could in essence say, he is, you're just not looking.
Yeah, and again, I don't think it's frequent, but yeah, there are cases.
And once I had someone send me what they thought were some of your most powerful cases. In fact, one of them in the list that stood out to me was a doctor who was treating someone with tuberculosis, and after prayer, that person was healed. And the doctor was able to verify this because he went on to marry this person and has been living with
yes.
her for several years.
Yes, I have that one in the book too, yes. Yes. Mm.
Yeah. And so, I mean, tuberculosis, conditions like that, they just don't disappear overnight. So.
Yeah. They do speak of tuberculosis going into remission, but that was mm-hmm. a pretty extraordinary mm-hmm. case.
Yeah. Now, another kind of case we need to talk about, I'd like to spend a lot of the next section talking about, but let's go ahead and start talking about, is a case of resurrections. And one of the ones that you were interviewed about was back in the time of John Wesley.
Yeah. Yeah, it was actually on Christmas Day in the 1740s. I could get the exact date if you need it, but it's in Wesley's journal. There was a Mr. Myrick who fell sick. Wesley fell sick about the same time. Wesley got better. Wesley often reports being healed, but in this case, Mr. Myrick died. Or again, so far as anybody could tell, he was dead. And Wesley went and prayed for him at his bedside, and Mr. Myrick revived. He came back to, mm-hmm. to life, as far as anybody could tell. We have a lot of those reports through church history. Many of the early church fathers claimed to be eyewitnesses of healings. Augustine, who was writing after some of the main witnesses, you know, Augustine had believed that those things weren't happening very much in his own day until he was confronted with the evidence of some of them happening, including with himself and a close friend of his, where an anal fistula was cured overnight or faster in answer to prayer. And anyway, there are just a lot of examples through history.
Now, you said a few times in the show, I think, that in your own circle of friends, you've got 10 accounts of resurrections taking place. And so this would even include taking place in the West, wouldn't it?
Somewhere in the West. Most of the reports I have were from my friends in
mm-hmm.
Africa.
Mm-hmm.
In the West, one of the ones that was actually in my brother's circle was some members of his church.
Mm-hmm.
After I became a Christian, my brother did, and a member of his church, the wife died. As far as anybody could tell, she was dead. There was no breathing. There was no pulse
mm-hmm.
detectable. And he prayed for her, and she came back. But
mm-hmm.
But there are so many more. A friend that I worked with in Nigeria, I'd never thought to ask him about miracles because that's not what we were dealing with when we were working together. But
mm-hmm.
once I was doing the book and had realized sometimes these things happen, I thought, well, I may as well ask him. I asked him. He prayed for. He was in a village where he was doing ministry, and the neighbors brought over their son and said, you know, our son is dead. Can you do anything? Can your God help him? And so he took him aside and prayed for about 2 or 3 hours and presented him back to the family alive. There's just a bunch of accounts.
Yeah, I've just... we've got a chat open here with our show, and I did see someone ask, could you give a name of an individual you claim was resurrected? And I'm guessing since this is someone in your own family, you could give specific names of individuals who have been supposedly resurrected, right?
Oh, yeah. I could give a number of names of individuals who have been resurrected. Therese Magnuha is my sister-in-law.
Mm.
One of the examples from the U.S. was one of my colleagues.
Mm-hmm.
Her father, she was a Greek teacher where I was teaching before, Debbie Watson. Her father, James Watson, was a Baptist pastor. Her sister, Gloria, had again, as far as they could tell, she was dead, but they prayed, and she was alive. There are the one that Chauncey Crandall. Chauncey Crandall is not from my circle of acquaintances. I wasn't including him in that list. But the doctor that I interviewed, the person that he prayed for and came back to life, is named Elaine Pinello. Is somebody I know in the Philippines who was raised. Leo Bawa is the Nigerian friend. He's a PhD student right now who prayed for the person in the village. Some other people in Congo who prayed for people to be raised. Jean Mabiala, Albert and Julian Bisweswe, both of them, each of them actually had an account of that. Dr. Ayo Adewuye was the professor, the Nigerian professor, who spoke up in the scholars session. After I moved here, this one isn't really recounted in the book. I think I may have squeezed it into a footnote last minute. But one of my neighbors here actually gave me an account. There's just I could keep going, but yeah, there are names in the book. Except where people ask me not to use names.
Yep.
There are quite a lot of names in the book.
Okay. Well, we've got some more to discuss about that when we come back, but a little bit overdue for our break, so we're going to take another break. We'll be back after this.
Hey, this is Minister Grock. Thanks for listening. Although Grock Radio is free, there are costs to upkeep the website, podcast, and purchase Bibles and materials for street ministry. And while we are happy to pay this ourselves out of pocket, we will gladly accept any gift if you feel led to support the shows and our street ministry. You can send a gift or love offering through our website at cyiworldwide.com. Thanks for your support, and God bless.
And we're back with Dr. Craig Keener. If you want to share a miracle claim or ask Dr. Keener a question, the call-in number is 714-242-5180. And with the donation plug that we just played, I would like to remind you that, yes, this show is listener-supported entirely, and that includes the work that I do here is also listener-supported. And people like Dr. Keener come, they give of their time, they don't get any pay for what they do, they just give of their time. We should be thankful for them. But if you want to donate, you can do so a number of ways. You can donate from my blog at deeperwaters.wordpress.com, and you can also donate through Ratio Christi to our Issues and Answers chapter. That's the one that I run, and they will make sure that I do give a donation. But we've got someone's wanted to call in here. You want to take a call, Dr. Keener?
Sure.
Okay. Caller, you are on the air.
Yes, I was wondering, Dr. Keener, if your book documents the miracles in American history.
It documents a number of claims in history, but it doesn't focus specifically on American history.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I see.
It does include some. I do have some from the 19th century and the 20th century.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's great.
Actually, I do have some from the 1700s, too. I forgot about that. Mercy Wheeler was a case from the 1700s. It really surprised people because a lot of people didn't believe it was supposed to happen. But she and some other individuals in the 1700s, a couple of the cases, this was a person who couldn't walk, hadn't walked for years, and they heard the scripture being read where Jesus said to someone, rise and walk, and they rose and walked.
I see. Well, I was wondering if you also included some that affected the country on a national level.
I don't think so. What are you thinking of?
Well, for instance, when George Washington was shot at by Indians, and there was accounts on both sides where he had holes in his coat, and it was a miracle that he actually survived. Being fired upon by the Indians, and then the Indians later confirmed that. But there are several accounts on our revolution where our forefathers, the founding fathers of our country, have documented that we became a country because God supernaturally intervened miraculously at several pivotal events. And I was,
I think you might
hoping...
be thinking about like the Haitian invasion and the fog coming in just at the right time.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's several things. They're documented actually at classicapologetics.com, Miracles in American History. But I thought maybe you might have mentioned some of these cases in your book.
No, I didn't mention those. I mainly was addressing healings at that point.
I see. Okay. Well, great. But it sounds like a wonderful book, and I'm looking forward to reading it.
Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay. I recognize that Carl is a good friend of mine. Now, if we were going to go to some of these resurrections again, and it is important to mention that in your book you do have some natural miracles, such as with weather and such, but with resurrections you did say that some of these were done by doctors and such, so for some of these there's even medical documentation, isn't there?
Well, in the case where there were doctors present, or nurses present, we have their testimony for those things.
Mm-hmm.
The nature miracles and the raisings from the dead are, I liked those categories because they're pretty hard to explain psychosomatically. However else you explain them,
yeah.
You can't say that a storm was stilled psychosomatically. But did you want me to deal with some cases of medical documentation?
Yeah, that would be great. And of course, if anyone wants even more medical documentation, if it's possible, it's by and large in your book, isn't it?
Yeah, either I have it or I refer to the sources that have it.
Okay. So let's get some more of those cases here.
Well, one of the cases that I found was Carl Cockerell, who I think he was about 60 years old, and he broke his ankle. He was on vacation in Missouri, and he broke his ankle. He was hospitalized. They made him stay overnight. They told him he had a broken ankle. They put a cast on him. But that night, he saw a light. He felt like God told him that he was healed. And he went back to Michigan, and the new x-ray showed that, in fact, he did not have a broken ankle. His doctor said, "You've never had a broken ankle." He showed him the first x-ray, and he said, "Now that's a broken ankle." So the x-rays were a week apart, but for a 60-year-old man, for his ankle to be broken and there to be no sign of the break a week later is pretty significant. Rex Gardner, he wrote a book called Healing Miracles. He also wrote an article that deals with some of this in the British Medical Journal. But he gives a number of examples with medical documentation. One of them is of a 9-year-old girl who was instantly healed from severe auditory nerve damage. Mm. And that's not supposed to happen. I mean, nerve damage is supposed to be irreversible. But
yeah.
she was healed of it. The audiologist, understandably, didn't believe it. Ran a nut, you know, he just... done an audiogram of her the day before, so he did another one, and he said, "I can't explain this, but her hearing is perfect." He has other accounts, including the healing of eye scarring. There are other accounts of that as well that are documented, but he has one in his book. One of my students, Donald Moore, clinical director of voice and swallowing disorders. He's had many years of experience, you know, knowing with what certain kinds of strokes, certain kinds of brain damage produce irreparable damage, and yet he had accounts. He couldn't, in one of the cases, he couldn't give me the information because, I mean, the guy said it was a miracle, but, you know, because of privacy laws, he can't tell me something directly with names or anything. But in another case, the patient gave him permission. He was able to put us in touch so I could get her story of her son. And he he was convinced it was a miracle. He'd absolutely told her, you know, deal with reality. Your son's always going to be this way. But her son was healed. And anyway, there are a number of accounts like this, some that I've interviewed and some that are published. Joy Wannenfried had vertical heteroforia. She actually was on the pamphlet. Hers was the picture used in the pamphlet to explain what this condition was. And you know, she provided for me her old eye records and so on. I mean, it was clear that she had this condition. It was also clear what kind of glasses she had to wear. After she was healed during a prayer meeting at Taylor University, I got the new certification from her that certifies that now she didn't need corrective lenses to drive. She had 20/20 vision. So there are a number of cases where there is medical documentation, and there are some books that do it. But this is an area where, again, I think we need to do a better job. It's hard to get medical documentation. Privacy laws, which are helpful, but with regard to getting medical documentation, they've made it more difficult for that. But we really need to do a good job on that.
Mm-hmm. Now, since you've talked about doctors who have written books, do you have any statistics on, for instance, what the medical profession by and large thinks about miracles? I mean, I know I went to my own doctor and said, "What have you seen any miracles?" And he just instantly said, yes, I've seen miracles take place. What's been your experience of talking with doctors about miracles?
A number of doctors I've talked with have said, yes, I've seen them. Some have said, no, I haven't. I believe in them, but I haven't seen them. And then some of them, you know, it depends on how you define miracle, too, and what standard of evidence you're using. And, of course, you know, in medical school, the standard is very rigorous. But the percentage of doctors who believe in miracles, according to a national survey that was done a few years ago, is over 70%. I think it's around 74%. And for those who claim to have witnessed medical miracles themselves, and this is in the same, I think it's the question right after in the survey, how many of you have witnessed these miracles? The answer was about 55%, so over half. And that's keeping in mind that some of them would define the standard of evidence very rigorously.
And it's important to realize that we might not have medical documentation for some reason, because a lot of the healings don't take place in a medical setting, especially if you're praying for someone in a church. Chances are it's not going to be a doctor necessarily there every single time that's going to be able to verify things.
Yeah, but I mean, I think even doctors would agree, you know, if you see cataracts disappear from somebody's eyes, you don't have to be a doctor to notice that. But then there are other things where we actually, people need to get medical verification just to know that they're better. The person in the Philippines who was raised that I know, she was very, she was dying of liver cancer. She didn't have any money to get treatment. The doctor told her, you've got to get the treatment or you're going to die. She had no way to get it. And so she did die. She was dead for an hour and, I think it was an hour and 45 minutes. Again, as far as anybody could tell, she was in the morgue. And then a Baptist pastor prayed for her. I don't know why she prayed for her, and my informant didn't know why either, because she was dead at the time. She wasn't conscious. She didn't understand all the circumstances of what happened. But anyway, she didn't have the money still to go back to the doctor, but eventually she had to go back because she wanted to get married. She didn't know if, you know, she had to make sure that the liver cancer was gone, and it was completely gone. And she found the doctor who had told her that she was going to die. Initially, the doctor didn't believe it was the same person. But when the doctor did believe it, that doctor was converted to Christianity.
Nice. Now, there's another genre of stories in your book that I think need to talk about, because we've talked about a lot of good things that have happened, but something to keep in mind is that there are a lot of dark powers out there as well. And
yeah.
Something you document in your book is that while we today are skeptical of anything like that, in much of the third world and such, this is seen as a constant reality that there are evil powers that are at work.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, besides divine miracles, besides psychosomatic healing, which, you know, if we get better, we can be glad for that too, but there's also cases of fraud, and then there's also what you're talking about now. And it's not something I particularly like to talk about, but it's...
Yeah.
It's I can give an example. This one is from my brother-in-law, who is a university chemistry professor. He has, a PhD from a French university. But there were these three boys in his Sunday school class who always were seen together. And one of them, the eldest one, fell sick. And then after a few months of the sickness, he died. And then the next one immediately fell sick, and after a couple months, he died. And then the third one fell sick, and at this point, he ran to the Sunday school teachers, and he said, I've got to tell you this story. The three of us, there was a man we met at night on the street, and he said that he would give us special power to become government ministers. And, you know, advance politically. He just wanted a little bit of our blood. And the youngest really didn't want to do it, but the others forced him to go along with it. And they could talk among themselves about it, but they weren't supposed to talk with anybody else, or they would lose the promised reward. Well, the one then had a nightmare that the same man appeared to him in a dream and stabbed him with the same knife. Well, after he fell sick immediately, after he died, the second one had the same nightmare, and he got sick and he died. The day that he died, the youngest one had the same nightmare, and he said, this is not working. And he ran to the Sunday school teachers and said, please pray for me. They prayed and fasted for 9 days for God to deliver him from this attack. And he was healed. Now, I know that a lot of people in the West, they may have listened to some of the other stuff. They may at this point say, oh, no, this is just totally outside my worldview. This cannot happen. I assure you, it was totally outside my worldview as well. This was one of the more uncomfortable parts of my research. But anyway, there are... Not everything spiritual in the world is necessarily positive.
Yeah. That's the problem I think we often have in the West today, that we look at anything spiritual. And we've got Bill McKeever coming on next week to talk about Mormonism. And I don't deny that Mormons have a spiritual experience, may have a burning in the bosom, but I deny that it's a good one. Or we can think about people like Oprah Winfrey and others and people that are involved in the New Age movement. And I think this is largely because we have a void that's been left when atheism has come in and people want spirituality. They don't necessarily want God. But your stories here, they tell us that we need to be on guard against spiritual matters because not every spirit is good.
Yeah, and I think many people are sincerely seeking the best that they know, but not everything out there is safe. Not everything out there is from the God who really loves us and gave his son for us. And and that's the dividing line. If God loved the world in such a way that he gave his son, then if he gave his son, he expects faith in his son. That was a big price that he paid. And we can't take it for granted. We have to take that very seriously.
Okay, we're going to take our final break, and when we come back, we'll be coming and wrapping things up with Dr. Craig Keener. I'm Nick Peters. You are listening to the Deeper Waters Podcast.
Oh, yeah. Hey, folks, it's Will ZPI, and you guys got to check out CYIWorldwide.com, home of the Grok Show, free MP3s, music, advice, and even prayer support. That, again, is CYIWorldwide.com. Check it out.
Okay, we've talked a lot about miracles with Dr. Craig Keener here, and our calling number is 714-242-5180. It's about 20 minutes left in the show, so if you want to call and share a miracle claim, there's not much time left, so you better go ahead and do it quickly. But we've talked about everything. We talk about healings. We talk about blind people being healed. We talk about resurrections. We've even talked about now demonic experiences, which we could include exorcisms, and some of those you have documented in your book. All of these show up in the New Testament.
Yeah. Actually, you know, in the anthropological literature, from maybe 74% of the world's cultures, I think that was the estimate as of a few decades ago. Spirit possession in some form or another has been documented in a wide range of cultures. Now, most of the anthropologists, I think, who have documented and described these experiences are not actually believers that these are actual spirits. And yet, what they describe fits very closely what we witness in the New Testament.
Mm-hmm. So, when we have all this information here, now we got all this, and we realize eyewitnesses do make these claims. Some of these claims can be verified. They can have credibility. What do we do now then when we return to the New Testament?
Well, first of all, and I think this is the argument of the book, that regardless of your philosophic presuppositions, you should accept, and that is, you can't look at the miracle claims in the New Testament and say these have to have arisen through the process of legendary accretion. There's no reason to say that these can't be eyewitness reports or based on eyewitness reports, the same that we would say for other kinds of material in the New Testament. The second issue is how we explain it, and I believe that we have sufficient evidence to invite us to explain miracles in a theistic way, to say that there is a God who does perform miracles. I mean, not every miracle claim that we experience necessarily is authentically, you know, a miracle, but we do experience miracles, and there's no reason to doubt, especially when you have an accumulation of them all in one place. I mean, you have an accumulation of them with Jesus. You have an accumulation of them with Jesus' followers acting in Jesus' name. There's very compelling reason to believe that God has acted in history in these ways.
Of course, when we say, don't dismiss every miracle claim, we also should be careful to not believe every miracle claim. But we should always be willing to test it. And with a general rule of thumb be that, you know, if you've tested it, and you might not be able to verify it, but the person seems to be reliable and such, that you should just give them the benefit of a doubt?
I would normally give a witness the benefit of the doubt if they're a reliable eyewitness. Now, there are different issues here, because sometimes it's something that just gets better on its own, and you can rejoice that the person got better, but you don't know for sure that it. I mean, it may be something just that God put in nature, in our bodies, that we just normally get better. That's not to dismiss that it's still God, but it's just when we talk about testing, there's different kinds of testing. One is testing to see whether it's authentic or not, whether the person is telling the truth or not. Another is, okay, we acknowledge that this happened, but we're just asking whether we can use this as compelling evidence. But we're not denying the person's faith that God really touched them in whatever way.
Yeah. Yeah. And at the same time, also, when someone gets sick, we're not telling them, just sit down and pray and don't do anything else. And even the faith healers you talk about in your book, they encourage people, go see your doctor, go get checked out. There's never any harm, and it's never a lack of faith to go to a doctor.
That's correct. And, you know, most of the people in the majority world where medical resources are lacking, sometimes people are desperate, and God answers their desperation with miracles. But far more people would be able to survive if medical resources were more widely available. And almost all the people I talked with in the majority world would agree with that, would affirm, yes, please, we need more medical resources. So it's not an either-or.
Yeah, and this should give us some motivation to go out and be doing the missionary work that Christ himself has already called us to, because good medical care has, for thousands of years, been a part of the Christian message, been a part of what we've done when we've been doing evangelism. Even in thing like the second century of the church, that there was a plague that swept through the Roman Empire, and even the church physician Galen noted that the non-Christian physician. He was noting that the Christians were the ones who were caring for the sick more than anyone else. In fact, I think even he fled the plague, didn't he?
he may have. I don't know that part. It would make sense. But yeah, it's true. Jesus' miracles, I mean, there can be different kind of miracles. I mean, you could have miracles of people being struck dead. There are a few of those in the Bible, but most of Jesus' miracles, well, actually, Jesus didn't strike anybody dead in the Gospels, but most of Jesus' miracles in the Gospels are healing or delivering people from spiritual powers that are hostile. So that gives us a model. We should care about what he cares about, and whether we're doing it through medical means, whether we're doing it through prayer, whether we're just standing with people and encouraging them and not letting them down in their time of need, whether we're providing resources for them. In all of those ways, it's working for the same purpose. We're still following the model of Jesus and caring about people and trying to make things better for them.
You know, we've had Mike Lacona and Gary Habermas both come on to talk about the resurrection, but with your background in miracles, what do you think now about the person who says something like, I'd be willing to believe anything that would explain the resurrection just to avoid the far less likely event that a dead person has come back to life?
I think that the evidence for Jesus' resurrection is compelling. You know, when you're using historical evidence, and I think Mike Lacona has pointed this out well, when you're using historical evidence, there are degrees of probability. But within the degree of, you know, reconstructing something from the first century, the evidence for Jesus' resurrection, the eyewitnesses, the price that they were willing to pay, I mean, all of that, I think, is very strong evidence for Jesus' resurrection. And ultimately, you know, we look at the evidence. The New Testament appeals to witnesses. You know, it expects us to look at evidence. But you look at the evidence, and it invites us to faith that's not a leap into the dark, but it's a deliberate step into the light of the truth. Because if this is where the evidence points, then we have a responsibility to respond to that evidence by entrusting our lives to the Lordship of Christ.
Yeah, I think what we could also point out is that we have to be consistently fair with how we're studying these claims. I mean, a lot of the claim for the resurrection, for instance, that's something we've got far more backing for than, say, the claim that Jesus turned water into wine. I mean, I think both of them happened, but if you're going...
Yeah.
And that not all miracle claims are equal. And we also have to realize that we can't give the Bible a special treatment. If we can find miracle claims outside of the Bible that do have good substantiation, then we should be able to accept those claims. I remember Mike once asked me, well, what about if Vespasian really did heal of a blind person, or what about if Apollonius really did do a miracle? I said, what about it? If they did, then that's just more evidence that miracles take place. That gives more credibility to what Jesus did.
Yeah. Yeah, I know Mike and I talked about this station also, because it's in both Tacitus and Suetonius, and that's,
mm-hmm.
you know, pretty soon, I mean, it's a few decades after the event, so I think we need to take that one fairly seriously.
Mm-hmm. And I do know there are several claims out there from atheists that say that we're willing to accept miracles in our own religion, but we're not allowed, we're willing to accept miracles in other religions. And this is one I find nonsense. I had a month or so ago some reading about a Muslim man online who said that he was healed of pancreatic cancer. I have no reason, prima facie, to deny that claim, even if it's done with someone outside my faith tradition.
Yes, yes. I mean, we talked earlier about the other spiritual powers, but in a case like this, I think also we can look at God is a God of love. He doesn't just
mm-hmm.
love Christians. He loves everybody, and if people are praying to God.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but what we have with the Christian faith is a pattern of miracles taking place in the name of Jesus that
mm-hmm.
in many places are driving the growth of biblical
mm-hmm.
Christian faith around the world.
Mm-hmm. And this was, in fact, one of the things that we see in the book of Acts, especially, which you've written so much on, is that miracles were very central to getting the people to pay attention to the message. And we usually find in the Bible that miracles happen at a time when new revelation is being given, that in the time of Moses, you have several miracles going to verify Moses' right to be a prophet and to lead the people. When the prophets start showing up, Elijah and Elisha, you have miracles showing up then. And then when Jesus comes on the scene finally, you have miracles going, because God knows that this is something new to his people, and he needs, and if they're going to believe it, then that needs to be verified somehow.
Yeah, and I think what we are seeing today is analogous to what we have in the book of Acts, where it's
mm-hmm.
groundbreaking evangelism. New areas
mm-hmm.
are being evangelized, and it's
mm-hmm.
often a confrontation with these other powers that you mentioned. Now, in addition
mm-hmm.
to the signs and wonders that are, you know, the kind that persuade people, we also have, the Bible talks about gifts of healings. It also talks in James chapter 5 about anointing the sick person and praying the prayer of faith. So that it's not just, those kinds of healings, or those kinds
mm-hmm.
of recoveries, they don't have to be dramatic to be answers to prayer.
No.
But the point of signs and wonders are to get people's attention for the gospel.
Mm-hmm.
So I think
mm-hmm.
we can distinguish. It's the same God doing both, but like the testimony earlier in the program, I mean, we can, again, thank God for that, even if it's not something that would persuade. Well, you know, the levels of persuadability depend on the individual, but...
And I think we could even go on.
So, usually, if it happens to us, it doesn't take as much to convince us.
Mm-hmm.
If it happens to somebody else, we usually ask for a higher level of evidence and so on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think we should also encourage you about going out there and doing missions work in these other countries, and God bless them for doing it. Don't be afraid to pray for someone who is sick. And there's no guarantee that something's going to happen, but for all you know, something could happen.
I've had it happen here.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, one time that totally shocked me, I was a young Christian at a nursing home Bible study, and the director of the there was this woman, Barbara, who always said, I wish I could walk. The leader of the Bible study, finally, after so many times of this, he walked over to her, took her by the hand, said, "In the name of Jesus Christ, rise up and walk." I was shocked. I was horrified. I could see by the expression on her face, she was horrified. Neither she nor I can be accused of having a presupposition of faith in that case. But he walked her around the room, and from then on, to her own astonishment, she began to walk. And, you know, I continued in the Bible study. I saw the effects. She actually was cured. Now, people might want to explain that in different ways, but it happens here as well as as well as elsewhere.
Yeah, I can kind of imagine, because I'd probably be in the same scenario as you were, thinking, oh my gosh, what are you doing? You know, if this doesn't work, you're just going to embarrass us all so much more.
Exactly, and plus she could be injured. I was really scared. Mm-hmm. But the Lord was leading him at that time. But that's not something I would advise people to do without absolute certainty, because the risk level is pretty high.
Now, we've only got about 5 minutes left in the show, but you've just come out with an Acts commentary. That's available on Amazon now, isn't it?
Yes. Volume 1 is out. Volume 2 is due out within the next few months, and they're publishing about one volume a year.
And do you have any idea of what's on the horizon after those are done?
I am working on study notes for a study Bible. I'm working on the New Testament part for Zondervan. And the Bible background commentary, the revised version, is due out early in 2014. I've just been finishing up work on that. And I've got a few other books I want to start on that I've talked with publishers about, but I need to get these things off my plate first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we certainly do appreciate you being willing to take time here. Let's suppose there's someone who's listening who says, you know, I'm really impressed by what I've heard today. What's the best way that I can reach Dr. Keener? How are you most accessible to the public?
It is really hard. I'm so far behind on emails that it's pretty hard to reach me. There's a website there's two websites, one that's my own and one that a friend runs for me that gives, like, some of my material. But in terms of reaching me, I do have an email through the seminary, but I just have to admit I'm way behind on answering emails already, so...
Yep.
Now, if it's an account of a healing, you can find the Global Medical Research Institute, because these are actually doctors who are working on this, medical doctors.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a different kind of doctor. They can work with this with the medical documentation, and they would be the ones to contact if that's what you have.
And are you still keeping in touch with these people as well, so that you can get the latest on miracle claims that are going on?
I have gotten so many miracle claims without trying to since the book came out that I'm not really collecting them anymore. But I am collecting them, actually, but I'm not sure what I'm going to do with my collection, because the book was, as you said, it was over 1,100 pages, and I'm working on other projects now. I'm hoping that others, there's so much to do on the subject, and students can write dissertations on it and so on. But I've got to get on to some other subjects.
Well, I really think this is one of the most valuable works that has been done for the church, really. And we've got about 2 minutes left, so what is the final message you would like to leave with the Deeper Waters listening audience?
Just to say that what the miracles point us to, first of all, they point us to the signs of the kingdom. They point us to the hope of the future, the hope of full restoration. And even though we don't have the fullness of it now, we can take courage because of these testimonies that we see God doing in different parts of the world. Secondly, we see that God is alive, God is real. Sometimes in the West we have gotten this idea that God works spiritually only, but it's not true. He's the God of all the universe. There's nothing too hard for God. And whether he does, he doesn't do everything that we might want him to do. He's God. He doesn't have to do everything we want him to do, but he loves us. He has our best interest at heart, and there's nothing that he can't do. There's nothing that's too hard for him.
Yeah, thank you very much, Dr. Keener, for taking your time. I know you're a busy man, but I really appreciate you coming on the show, and I hope we'll see you again here sometime.
Thank you so much, Nick.
Glad to have you. Remember, next week, everyone, we'll be having Bill McKeever of the Mormon Research Ministry come on, so gather your questions about Mormonism. It should be a very good time. Well, now, I'm Nick Peters of the Deeper Waters Podcast, signing off until next week.